Any company worth its salt uses accounting rules to smooth its peaks and valleys, says one former Enron accountant. But with Enron, it got to a point where it was so prolific, says another former Enron accountant. Budget shortfalls weren't just business issues, they were accounting issues. There was an absolute conviction at Enron that clever accounting could alter the business reality. That was an excerpt from The Smartest Guys in the Room, and this is part two of our series on Enron. If you missed part one, I suggest going back and listening to that first. Just as a small recap, last time we discussed the Enron origin story. We learned about Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling. We learned about the different Enron business lines and the corrosive culture, their obsession with the stock price, and how they started taking some accounting liberties to ensure they hit earnings targets. Today, I want to start by telling you about the man behind all the accounting liberties. That man is Andrew Fastow. Fastow joined Enron when he was 28 years old. He was hired by Skilling because he knew how to set up complex financial structures, specifically securitizations. By the age of 36, Fastow was Enron's CFO. He was wildly unqualified to be the CFO, but he got the job because Skilling needed him around to create his crazy structures. And when the CFO role opened up, Fastow said he would leave if the job wasn't his. So the job became his. And under Fastow, accounting became a profit center. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, there was an absolute conviction at Enron that clever accounting could alter the business reality. Let me read you another passage so you can see exactly what I mean. And this is probably one of my favorite passages from the book. Here's how another former employee describes the process. Say you have a dog, but you need to create a duck on the financial statements. Fortunately, there are specific accounting rules for what constitutes a duck. Yellow feet, white covering, orange beak. So you take the dog and paint its feet yellow and its fur white, and you paste an orange plastic beak on its nose. And then you say to your accountants, "This is a duck. Don't you agree that it's a duck?" And the accountants say, "Yes, according to the rules, this is a duck. Everybody knows that it's a dog, not a duck, but that doesn't matter because you've met the rules for calling it a duck." And there was the ultimate problem. With Enron's financial team working feverishly to exploit the rules, there was no one willing to say that the duck was still a dog. Because they could come up with plausible rationales for why a given structure was technically valid, they believed they were on the right side of the law. They were, in fact, proud of what they were doing. In their view, they were doing what every other company was doing, except they were doing it better and smarter because they were Enron, where everything was done better and smarter. But while people at Enron were smart about bending the rules, they were not smart at all about understanding where all that bending was taking them. We'll talk in a bit about where all this bending was taking them, and I'll give you some examples of the dogs they were calling ducks. But before we get there, it's important to understand how bad incentives and the market environment at the time allowed these things to happen. Part of the reason Enron felt justified in calling a dog a duck was that their auditors at Arthur Andersen were signing off on the different structures, transactions, and accounting treatments. This is from the book. The accountants in Arthur Andersen's Houston office worked so closely with Enron that they came to see the world in the same way as Enron executives, nor did they want to risk losing one of their biggest clients. This was also part of the modern bull market, a gradual disintegration of the high standards that accountants had once proudly upheld. We talked briefly about consultant capture in the last episode, but it's an important part of the Enron story, so I want to cover it again. Firms like Arthur Andersen that had previously been accounting firms were adding new business lines, specifically consulting. The consultants generated more money than the accountants, and the accountants were expected to help the consultants get a foot in the door. So now the people auditing a company's books had this perverse incentive to keep the client happy, because there was a lot of consulting revenue on the line. As the authors wrote, by the 1990s, there were few firms willing to quit an account on principle. There was simply too much money at stake. Not surprisingly, accounting standards eroded and accounting fraud mushroomed. So a few other things to keep in mind here. By the year 2000, Enron was paying Arthur Andersen $52 million per year. They were considered a crown jewel client for Andersen. Over the course of their relationship, Enron hired away 86 Andersen employees. And finally, there were about 100 Andersen employees working on the Enron account. And rather than working at the Andersen office, they had offices at Enron, where they worked side by side with the Enron accountants, with the people whose books they were auditing. As you can imagine, Andersen was strongly incentivized to keep Enron happy and strongly disincentivized to enforce tough decisions that an auditor is supposed to enforce. Imagine being an Andersen accountant and thinking you have a chance to go work at Enron someday, where you'll make a lot more money and have valuable stock options. You're going to do everything in your power to make Enron happy and increase your chances of being hired. So this discussion brings to mind two of our maxims. Beware of bad incentives, and frauds are a product of the times. As an investor or entrepreneur, it's vitally important to understand the incentives of the people you're dealing with. Incentives drive actions, and if you ignore bad incentives, you're setting yourself up for failure. As far as frauds being a product of the times, we've seen this in every single fraud we've studied so far. Madoff, Theranos, FTX, even Rudy the Wine Forger. I talked about these examples in more detail in episode 4 of this season, but the important takeaway with this maxim is that there's value in asking yourself a few questions when evaluating an investment. First, what is unique about this point in time that might be making me overlook an issue with this investment? Second, am I feeling any FOMO, fear of missing out, around this investment? And finally, if this turns out to be a fraud, what is a red flag that I should have noticed? It's really challenging to understand the phenomenons that are playing out without the benefit of hindsight, but these questions might help you avoid some manias. And then one other thing I want to touch on here. Arthur Andersen had actually been caught up in a couple different accounting scandals before Enron blew up. As an investor, if the company you're investing in is using an auditor that has been involved in accounting scandals, it might be best to just avoid investing in that company. I'm not sure how broadly applicable this rule will be, but it's something worth considering. All right, so we understand that Enron was employing creative accounting to bend the rules in their favor, but let's talk about a couple examples of what they were doing specifically. Most of what FastDial was doing had one of four distinct goals: keeping debt off the books, masking existing debt, booking earnings, or creating operating cash flow. As the authors wrote, at their absolute essence, the deals were intended to allow Enron to borrow money, billions upon billions of dollars that it needed to keep itself going, while disguising the true extent of its indebtedness. I think we've mentioned this briefly already, but Enron had a lot of business lines that weren't very profitable. It could book earnings and make the company look good, but they weren't generating the cash necessary to run the company. Enron expected these businesses to become profitable, but in the meantime, they needed cash to run the business. So they used Andy Fastow's global finance group to raise about $20 billion worth of capital per year. Here's an example from the book. To see how Enron used these building blocks and how they mutated in complexity, consider a structure called White Wing. White Wing began life in December 1997 as something called a minority interest transaction, which took advantage of various accounting rules governing the way business ventures with third parties are reported in a company's financial statements. Enron borrowed $579 million from Citigroup and then raised another $500 million, mostly debt, from an entity affiliated with Citi, plus a sliver of equity from other investors. White Wing, in turn, used this money to buy $1 billion in Enron preferred stock. The White Wing structure was not a secret. It was disclosed in Enron's financial statements, but the $500 million showed up on the financial statements not as debt, but as a minority interest in a joint venture. The primary purpose of the transaction had been to convert debt to equity, is how corporate treasurer Jeff McMahon later described the transaction to Enron's board. That was true only in a technical sense. The $500 million hadn't been converted, it had only been disguised. Enron was still responsible for paying the money back. This was one of the first times that Enron used its stock, the value of the preferred shares in White Wing, to support an off-balance sheet financing. It was not the last. Something important to keep in mind about these deals is that most of them had some type of trigger, meaning that if Enron's stock dipped below a set price, or if their credit dipped below a certain rating, they would be required to pay the money back immediately. That's an important point, and we're going to return to that later. Here's another example. Another kind of minority interest transaction took place toward the end of 1999, when Enron was desperate to show cash flow. In a deal called Project Nahani, Enron, in essence, borrowed $485 million from Citigroup and raised a sliver of equity, $15 million, through a minority interest financing, used that money to buy treasury bonds, sold the treasury bonds, and booked the proceeds as cash flow from operations under the pretext that buying and selling bonds was part of Enron's day-to-day business. That $500 million represented a staggering 41% of the total $1.2 billion in operating cash flow that Enron reported that year. Then, right after the first of the year, when the camouflage was no longer necessary, Enron repaid Citi. All right, I want to talk about another technique Enron used called securitization. Basically, when you securitize something, you estimate the future cash flow of an asset, sell it to investors at a discount, and take the cash now instead of in the future. Companies often use special purpose entities to do this in order to isolate risk. But one of the weird accounting treatments Enron took advantage of was the rule stating that special purpose entities were independent if 3% of the capital came from an independent source. So basically, Enron could put up 97% of the money to buy assets from themselves, record the sale as income, but not include the debt because it technically came from an independent entity. This is from the book. Securitization, at least the way Enron did it, provided a great short-term boost. But as with so many other Enron deals, it created ticking time bombs of debt. Debt that was rarely supported by the true value of the asset, because it was often based on unreasonably optimistic assumptions about what would happen over a period of years. It was a purported sale, but it looked and smelled like a financing, as a former Enron International executive puts it. It also created holes for the future. After all, if you've generated earnings and cash from selling something, you can't claim those earnings or cash flow the next year or any year afterward. Enron borrowed from the future until there was nothing left to borrow, says one Enron executive. If shareholders understood the extent to which the future was being mortgaged, ponders another. At the time of its bankruptcy, Enron had over $2 billion in off-balance sheet debt related solely to securitizations. So that was securitizations, but we also need to talk about prepays. Here's another explanation from the book. The Enron bankruptcy examiner later called prepays the company's quarter-to-quarter cash flow lifeblood. While there were many variations on the theme, here's how a typical one worked. Enron would agree to deliver natural gas or oil over a period of time to an ostensibly independent offshore entity that was, in fact, set up by one of its lenders. The offshore entity would pay Enron upfront for these future deliveries with money it had obtained from the lender. The lender, in turn, agreed to deliver the same commodity to Enron. Enron would pay a fixed price for those deliveries over a period of time. On the surface, these looked like separate transactions. But in reality, the commodity part of the deal canceled out, leaving Enron with a promise to pay a lender a fixed return on money it had received. In other words, it looked suspiciously like a loan with interest. Nevertheless, Enron listed prepays not as debt, but as trading liabilities that were supposedly offset by trading assets. And although there are Enron finance executives who to this day claim that prepays were trading liabilities, one would be hard-pressed to find an independent observer who would agree that they shouldn't have been classified as debt on Enron's books. Okay, so to quickly recap, Enron was using securitization, special purpose entities, and prepays to generate cash flow and move debt off their books. As we discussed earlier, Enron's accountants were facilitating this bad behavior, but so were their bankers. For all these transactions we just talked about, Enron needed bankers. I'm going to read you a few different quotes from the book that underline this point. Every bit as much as the accountants at Arthur Andersen, the banks and investment banks were Enron's enablers. By the late 1990s, Enron had become one of the largest payers of investment banking fees in the world. According to the company's own calculations, it paid out $237 million in fees in 1999 alone. By the end, Citi was reaping some $50 million a year from Enron. There were also lots of whispers in the banking world that Enron consumed incredible amounts of capital, that the company was way overleveraged, that, as one internal Citigroup email explicitly put it, Enron significantly dresses up its balance sheet for year-end. But despite the whispers, indeed, despite knowing far more than most people about what was really going on inside Enron, few bankers were willing to stop doing business with the company. They were hooked too. So again, we should always beware of bad incentives. The bankers were incentivized to help Enron do any shady or unethical deal they wanted to do because they were making insane amounts of money in fees. But the most important thing to remember here is that Andy Fastow's group was basically the cash engine for Enron, and they did that mostly through taking on debt and disguising the fact that it was actually debt. All right, let's get to the why behind Enron's actions. Enron was working on two big businesses that were supposed to bring in big profits. Those were Enron Energy Services and Broadband. As the authors wrote, Enron's accounting games were never meant to last forever. The goal was to maintain the impression that Enron was humming until Skilling's next big idea kicked in and started raking in real profits. As an aside here, Enron's actions all trace back to greed. Wanting to get too big, too soon, too fast, as Morgan Housel would say. And when anything grows at a rapid pace, whether that's a human, investment returns, or company profits, things start to break. Enron had a solid business in natural gas. The pipelines, the trading, the gas bank, those all worked. But they wanted more. They wanted to be a growth company. They wanted to be valued like the internet companies of the late 1990s. And that pushed them into doing stupid things and, eventually, breaking. The Enron Energy Services and Broadband businesses were a couple of those stupid things. The idea behind EES was that Enron would provide energy directly to retail customers as markets became deregulated. There were many problems with this plan, the first of which was that the retail energy market wasn't really moving toward deregulation. Enron launched a pilot program to provide energy to residential customers, and it failed miserably. So they pivoted and started providing energy services to businesses. Enron acted as an energy subcontractor to businesses, handling all their energy needs from negotiating contracts, to paying bills, to maintaining equipment, to increasing efficiency. EES was winning contracts left and right, but they were winning contracts for two big reasons. They were offering energy at a discount, meaning Enron would be taking a loss, and they were paying companies to sign up. The idea was that they could afford to sign some losing deals with big-name companies because that would generate buzz around the business so later they could sign profitable deals. But they also believed they would make money back by increasing energy efficiency. So they're signing all these deals, most of which will turn out to be money-losing deals, but they were reporting a very misleading number to Wall Street, total contract value. This is from the book. By the end of 1999, the company had signed up so many new customers that the total contract value, according to Enron, was a stunning $8.5 billion. It's important to note, however, that this total contract value, the phrase Enron was using to keep score, bore no relation to either revenues or profits. The term merely represented Enron's calculation of the cost of all the energy and infrastructure needs a customer had outsourced to EES over the life of the contract. If Enron agreed to supply $500 million worth of electricity to a large corporation over a 10-year period, that $500 million was included as part of the total value of the contract, even if Enron was likely to lose money on the sale. But the number was still useful to the company. It was a way to show growth and to dazzle Wall Street. So that was incredibly misleading, but so was this. Back to the book here. Back in January 1998, at a time when Skilling was intent on convincing Wall Street that EES was taking off, Enron invited the analysts who covered the company to Houston for an annual meeting with the company's top executives. As part of the event, Enron officials gave the analysts a tour of the company's operations, including EES. The group was escorted to the sixth floor of Enron headquarters, where they were shown what was described as the EES War Room. There, they beheld the very picture of a sophisticated, booming business. A big, open room, bustling with people, all busily working the telephones and hunched over computer terminals, seemingly cutting deals and trading energy. Giant plasma screens displayed electronic maps, which could show the sites of EES's many contracts and prospects. Commodity prices danced across an electronic ticker. It was impressive, recalls analyst John Olson, who at the time covered the company for Merrill Lynch. It was a veritable beehive of activity. It was also a veritable sham. The war room had been rapidly fitted out explicitly to impress the analysts. Though EES was then just gearing up, Skilling and Pye had staged it all to convince their visitors that things were already hopping. On the day the analysts arrived, the room was filled with Enron employees. Many of them, though, didn't even work on the sixth floor. They were secretaries, EES staff from other locations, and non-EES employees who had been drafted for the occasion and coached on the importance of appearing busy. One, an administrative assistant named Kim Garcia, recalls being told to bring her personal photos to make it look as if she actually worked at the desk where she was sitting. She spent most of the time talking to her girlfriends on the phone. After getting the all-clear signal, Garcia picked up her belongings and returned to her real desk on the ninth floor. The analysts had no clue they'd been hoodwinked. Just as Enron's financial executives convinced themselves that their financial shenanigans stayed within the rules, it seemed so EES executives reasoned that this deception wasn't a problem. Eventually, EES really would use all that space. Eventually, there would be hundreds of busy employees working the phones and trading energy, and the division would be every bit as fabulous as they were telling investors. It just wasn't quite there yet. In many ways, Skilling's little Potemkin village stood as the perfect metaphor for EES. So much of what outsiders were led to believe about the operation was at odds with what was really going on. Listening to Skilling and Pye describe it, EES sounded like a business that made sense. That's one reason all the analysts were so willing to buy in. But it never made sense for Enron. So that passage reminds me very much of Theranos, which we covered in episode 2. Theranos was regularly running demos with fake results and telling partners and investors that they had capabilities that they actually didn't. And it was based on the same logic. Eventually we will get there. But eventually, they did not get there. And that was largely because Enron was a deal-making company, not a company known for operational excellence. This passage from the book makes that painfully clear. Meanwhile, promised energy-saving projects were never started, unpaid utility bills piled up, and EES tried to wiggle out of provisions it had agreed to that were either too difficult to perform or too expensive. Take the California Public University's contracts, which required EES to build a university system for energy use on each of their 31 campuses. According to David DeMauro, a Cal State administrator who helped manage the school's deal with EES, Enron routinely made major billing errors and submitted its bills late. In fact, says DeMauro, from the very first month that the contract went into effect, EES never got it right. There were no situations, he says, where the bills were either on time or correct. People either didn't get the bills or they got incorrect bills. We went all 4 years without receiving timely or accurate bills. We figured a company like this could do something as easy as turning out timely, accurate bills. They were never able to do so. The problem was so widespread over our campuses, says DeMauro, we decided that our strategy would be that we would not pay Enron until they could deliver us an accurate bill. We probably went 5 or 6 months without paying Enron at all. I would guess our accounts payable was approaching $40 million or so. Enron never delivered the energy efficiency projects it had promised either, says DeMauro. The one constant in dealing with Enron, he says, people we worked with were always making promises that weren't kept. Enron also had a contract with the giant HMO Kaiser Permanente to handle utility bills for hundreds of facilities in several states. but EES habitually paid the wrong amounts and ran up late fees as well. At one point, while Enron tried to straighten the mess out, boxes of unpaid Kaiser bills stacked up in EES's offices. EES's cash management was so poor that it took months to invoice customers for reimbursement of utility bills it had already paid. "We were basically paying their utility bills and giving them loans," says an Enron managing director who studied the situation. According to EES executives, the float was costing the business more than $50 million a year. How are we actually going to do all this shit that we're selling? An EES back office manager named Glenn Dixon recalls asking. The approach was, let's sell it and we'll figure out everything else later. They touted themselves as a risk management company, but they never asked what could go wrong. It was a free-for-all, a chaotic fucking free-for-all. So it's not hard to see why EES, one of the businesses that was supposed to be a cash cow, actually turned out to be a dud. The other business was broadband. Why broadband? That question is answered perfectly by these lines from the book. Anyone who remembers the internet mania of the late 1990s will understand perfectly why Skilling touted broadband as the next big thing for Enron. Internet stocks had taken off. Companies would go public in the morning and have a $100 share price by 4 p.m. Valuations were so high they bore no relation to profits or revenues, which, for many internet companies, were non-existent. If Skilling was going to get Enron an internet-style valuation, and there was nothing he wanted more, he'd have to convince Wall Street that Enron was becoming, at least in part, an internet company. The plan behind the broadband business was to lay a national network of fiber optic cables, distribute video content over the network, think Netflix before Netflix, and of course, trading bandwidth. Like EES, this business didn't pan out how Enron had hoped, but more on that later. As you can imagine, because these businesses didn't start printing cash as planned, Enron had to keep playing their accounting games. And Andy Fastow was happy to keep playing games because he found a way to profit from them. The short version of this story is that Fastow set up a series of private equity funds, I'll refer to them as the LJM funds, whose sole purpose was to buy assets from Enron at quarter end when Enron needed to hit their numbers. Fastow's LJM funds would buy the assets from Enron so Enron could book earnings, and then Enron would buy those assets back later at a higher price. Here's a little explanation from the book. By the late 1990s, Enron was making such frequent use of SPEs that finding the necessary outside equity investors was becoming nearly impossible. There were only so many trusted friends of Enron, after all. So Fastow began promoting the idea of setting up a big standing private equity fund, a sort of permanent friend of Enron, that would raise enough cash from institutional investors to provide the all-important 3% independent equity for dozens of Enron deals. This was an elegant solution, Fastow argued. It would avoid the messiness of having to find new investors every time. It would allow Enron to close deals faster than ever. It would even save money on banking fees. And, Fastow argued to Skilling, it wouldn't distract from his regular duties at Enron. Fastow was right that this would solve Enron's problem of finding new investors for their SPEs, but the fact is that they were solving a problem that they shouldn't have had in the first place. They were using SPEs to plug holes in their poor businesses. And because Enron needed to solve this problem, they ultimately ended up doing something that was bad for the company and good for Fastow, negotiating costly deals just to make their financial statements look good for Wall Street. As an example, Fastow invested $1 million into the first LJM fund and made over $25 million. You might be wondering where Fastow came up with the money for a private equity fund. That's an easy answer. He tapped the banks that worked with Enron. All the big banks wanted Enron's investment banking business, and Fastow made it known that investing in his LJM fund was a requirement for earning Enron's business. He also sold investors by saying he had inside knowledge of deals because of his position at Enron. Here's an excerpt from the book. What's remarkable about all this is that Fastow wasn't using his inside information to cherry-pick Enron's best deals, as he'd promised his investors. The projects he was steering LJM into were among Enron's worst, the dogs the company couldn't unload on anyone else. Yet even when these investments further deteriorated in LJM's portfolio, Fastow's fund almost always managed to make a profit. The reason was simple. The game was rigged. LJM was really just doing Enron's dirty work, warehousing troubled assets, allowing Enron to get them off its balance sheet and book the profits and cash flow it desperately needed to please Wall Street. LJM's real business was making Enron look good, and in return, LJM was getting paid handsomely for its troubles through secret special arrangements with Enron. Almost all of LJM2's deals, 21 of 23, were related to Enron. Excluding five assets LJM2 held at the time of Enron's collapse, the fund made money on all but one of them, generating $85.3 million in profits. Of the 16 Enron-related assets that LJM2 sold profitably, 14 went straight back to Enron, or a related entity, most in a matter of months, even when their value had dropped. So these deals were obviously a bad thing, but just how much were they propping up Enron's business? Let's take a look at this short passage. On January 18th, 2000, Enron issued a press release announcing its fourth quarter results. Enron continues strong earnings growth. The company reported earnings of $1.17 per share, matching Wall Street's expectations. The LJM and Merrill deals had contributed more than half of the quarter's profits. Without the transactions, Enron would have missed its number. A near catastrophe had been averted. You won't be surprised that Fastow's funds were one of the things that ended up bringing Enron down, but I'm getting ahead of myself. In each of the frauds we've studied this season, there's a recurring question I find interesting. Who should have known this was a fraud, but didn't? In Madoff's case, it was the SEC. With Theranos, it was their partners, specifically Walgreens. With SBF and FTX, it was the investors. And with Rudy Kernioan, it was the auction houses. Sometimes the reason was incompetence. Sometimes people were blinded by desire. Sometimes people were caught up in a mania. And often, incentives were misaligned. Unlike the other frauds we've studied, Enron was a publicly traded company. You could argue that the red flags, at least some of the red flags, were much more public than in the other cases. Enron's auditors and bankers definitely should have known. Likely they did know, but we've already discussed the bad incentives that kept them from doing anything. The other two groups who should have known were the analysts, both the credit and the equity analysts. Here are a couple of great excerpts from the book. At the tail end of a bull market that had run for nearly a decade, any company with a flashy stock chart and an eye-popping price-to-earnings ratio took on an aura of invincibility. None more than Enron. Enron is literally unbeatable at what they do, raved David Fleischer, a securities analyst at Goldman Sachs. The industry standard for excellence, chimed in Deutsche Bank's Edward Torello. Enron is the one to emulate, wrote the Financial Times. Any remaining vestiges of skepticism were washed away in the torrent of praise that showered over the company and its top executives. Enron's nearly incomprehensible financial statements? Nobody worried about them. The related party transactions buried in the footnotes? Who bothered with footnotes? That Skilling himself sometimes seemed unable to give a coherent explanation of Enron's business? At times, he got by with saying, "We're a cool company." It bothered no one. All that mattered was that the stock was going up. Because the stock was rising, Enron's executives were seen as brilliant. Enron was hardly the only company to see its stock ascend on a cloud of hype as the 1990s came to a close, but it was different from most such companies in one critical respect. The circle of people who knew, or should have known, that Enron's glittering surface masked a different reality was surprisingly large. Much of what Enron did, such as generating billions in off-balance sheet debt, was out in the open. Many of the analysts knew full well that the company's earnings far outstripped the cash coming in the door. The bankers and investment bankers who worked for the same firms as the analysts certainly understood what Enron was doing. Indeed, they made Fastow's deals possible. The credit rating agencies knew a lot. The business press, which could have looked more closely at Enron's financial statements, couldn't be bothered. The media was utterly captivated by the company's transformation from stodgy pipeline to new economy powerhouse. And of course, there were any number of Enron's own employees who could see for themselves how the company was making its numbers. And yet, they all chose not to make the logical leap, to see where it was inevitably headed. Instead, they all chose to believe. Everyone loved Enron. So one of the major points from that last bit was how several groups of people should have known. Let's start with the securities analysts. Spoiler alert, it involves our maxim, beware of bad incentives. Like I said earlier, many of the warning signs were available in Enron's reports and disclosures. Analysts knew that Enron's profits were more reflective of their accounting than their underlying business. They knew about the off-balance sheet debt. They also knew about the LJM partnerships, although they didn't know that they belonged to Fastow. This is from the book. Analysts who worked for Wall Street banks later claimed that they had been deceived by Enron. But if they were indeed victims, they were willing ones. For any analyst to say that there were no warning signs in the public filings, they could not have read the same public filings that I did. Howard Schlitt, an independent analyst who is the president of the Center for Financial Research and Analysis, later told Congress. There were two main reasons the analysts turned a blind eye to Enron's shenanigans. The first was personal gain. In the late 90s, being an analyst had become a glamorous job. Not only did they make a lot of money, but they became famous in the investing world. But it was only the bullish analysts who became rich and famous. Here's an example from the book. Kurt Lawner was a longtime, well-respected natural gas analyst, but by the late 1990s, his career had become a perfect example of the rewards an analyst could reap by playing the game according to the new rules. In his reports, he didn't seem to have any particularly deep insights into Enron's business. His understanding of the business was such that he told at least one investor that Enron was a trust me story. Some at the company didn't think much of him. He loved going to lunch with Skilling and Lay, recalls one former top executive. He was never into the numbers, and he didn't understand the trading business even after we spent years explaining it to him. But he pounded the table for a soaring stock. In both 1998 and 1999, Lawner was named Institutional Investor Magazine's number one rated natural gas analyst, largely on the strength of his long-standing buy signal on Enron. Number one rated analysts tended to make $1 million a year or more. So bullish analysts made a lot of money. But the second reason was that bullish analysts made a lot of money for their banks as well. That money came in the form of investment banking business. Let's go back to the book here. There was simply too much investment banking business at stake not to have a screaming buy on the stock. When a company was trying to decide which investment banking firm to choose for an IPO, for instance, analysts would accompany the bankers and help pitch the business. More important, analysts would promise to produce favorable research on the company once it went public. Without question, an analyst who made this promise was betraying investors to help his firm land banking fees. And in the aftermath of the bull market, analysts were raked over the coals for having done so. But in the late 1990s, any analyst who spent much time worrying about the obvious conflict wouldn't be a Wall Street analyst for very long. Over time, many companies came to expect buy recommendations from analysts. It was often a prerequisite for getting banking business. And the more banking business a company did, the more leverage it had over the analysts who covered it. Enron, which paid some of the highest investment banking fees in corporate America, had an immense amount of leverage, which it used shamelessly. Enron has a simple attitude. We do over $100 million of investment banking business a year. You get some of it if you have a strong buy, says one analyst. So it's pretty clear why the equities analysts kept giving Enron strong ratings. What's less clear is how the credit analysts missed all the warning signs. The credit rating agencies are responsible for determining a company's ability to repay debt. Having a good credit rating was crucial to Enron's business because, as we've discussed already, they didn't have much cash flow, so most of their operating capital came from debt in various forms. And most of that debt was dependent on maintaining a specific credit rating. If Enron's rating fell below a designated threshold, they would immediately be required to repay the debt. Enough of a downgrade, and Enron's business would crumble almost instantly. So was it also bad incentives that led the credit analysts to miss all the red flags? I don't think so. Sadly, I believe the answer was incompetence. Here are some good explanations from the book. The S&P analysts also claimed that they didn't know about LJM or Fastow's involvement in the fund. When investigators pointed out that both of those items had been disclosed in Enron's publicly filed 1999 proxy statement, the S&P analysts responded, incredibly, that they had not read the document. The agencies argue that Enron's BBB+ rating appropriately reflected all of these risks, that it was Enron's lies that caused the problem. But even that doesn't excuse their optimism. They are supposed to scrutinize a company's publicly filed financial statements, footnotes included, and if they didn't understand something, they certainly had the leverage to get more information. Yet even as Enron's debt ballooned, as the related party disclosures in its financial statements grew longer and more incomprehensible, as the numbers got even bigger, as more and more profits came from the inherently volatile trading operation, the agencies didn't sound the alarm. The real problem was that while the credit analysts saw many of the pieces that made up Enron's convoluted financing structure, they never added them all up, and so they never realized how truly precarious it was. And so, instead of acting as the ultimate watchdog, the credit analysts unwittingly served the opposite purpose. They gave all the other market participants a false sense of security. Stock analysts and investors alike took solace in the fact that the credit analysts gave Enron an investment-grade rating. After all, the credit analysts had access to lots more information than the equity analysts, so if they thought Enron was secure, then surely there was nothing to worry about. Thus did the responsibility to truly analyze Enron land nowhere, and thus the stock continued its climb. So this debacle with the credit agencies reminds me very much of what happened with Bernie Madoff and the SEC. The SEC was the watchdog in charge of preventing what happened with Madoff, much like Moody's and Standard & Poor's were the watchdogs in the Enron case. And in both instances, they had the information they needed to know something was wrong, but they lacked the expertise to accurately analyze and act on the information. So what can we do with these data points? What useful conclusions can we draw? A couple things come to mind. First, don't rely on regulators. That's not to say they're incompetent or won't protect you, but you shouldn't count on it. Second, two of our maxims. Ask an expert and beware of bad incentives. Asking an expert has been the best form of prevention in basically every case we've studied so far. With Madoff, it was Ed Thorpe and Harry Markopoulos. With Theranos, it was Kevin Hunter. With Rudy Kernewan, it was the wine experts hired after it was already too late. But in every case, the people who really knew the industries and understood the businesses could spot the problems every time. And combining that with our maxim on bad incentives, you can't ask an expert who has a dog in the fight. Sure, an equity analyst is an expert, But if they're working for the bank underwriting the deals on the company they're rating, that's a conflict of interest. These maxims are turning out to be our strongest, and I'll continue to keep them top of mind when I evaluate deals in the future. Those maxims are ask an expert and beware of bad incentives. All right, one other thing I want to touch on briefly before we move on. And this is something we talked about in the first Enron episode, but it's worth mentioning again. At the height of their popularity, Enron was getting positive publicity everywhere. They were the subject of numerous Harvard Business School case studies, a handful of management books were published about Enron, and Fortune magazine named Enron the most innovative company for 6 years in a row. But you know what's interesting about that? Fortune magazine also put Elizabeth Holmes and Sam Bankman-Fried on their covers. It's a good reminder of another one of our maxims. Praise is noise, skeptics are signal. If you rely on a magazine cover or a 60 Minutes feature as part of your due diligence, you're setting yourself up for failure. Investigative journalism is worth paying attention to. Articles praising companies and founders are not. All right, that was a big chunk of actionable info, but let's get back to the storyline for a bit. Before reading this book, two things came to mind when I thought about Enron. The first was accounting fraud, and the second was the California energy crisis. We've been talking a lot about the accounting fraud. Let's spend some time on California. In the first Enron episode, we talked about Skilling's push into the electricity markets and Enron's purchase of the Portland Electric Utility. They did this so they would have access to the California market, which was one of the only deregulated markets in the country, and so they would have electricity to trade. It would have been in Enron's best interest as a company to ensure deregulation in California worked well, because then California would have been a model for other states to deregulate, and Enron would have had more markets to enter. But the interests of Enron as a company didn't align with the interests of the traders who worked for Enron. And those traders quickly learned that the system in California was easy to game. California created two agencies when they deregulated, and these agencies were responsible for setting prices and ensuring reliability. These agencies had a bunch of different rules, which the traders quickly learned and took advantage of. For example, power generated in California had a price cap, but if demand increased and the agencies needed to purchase power from out of the market, there was no price cap. So the traders learned a technique called megawatt laundering, where they would route the power out of the state and then bring it back in so they could sell it at higher prices. Another rule was that if power lines became congested, one of the agencies would pay a power company to move electricity through their lines to relieve the congestion. So of course, Enron traders intentionally created congestion so they could get paid to relieve it. What was the result of these shenanigans? As you might guess, insane power prices and rolling blackouts. In June of 2000, the electricity cost in the Bay Area was $3.6 billion, which was half of what electricity had cost for the entire year of 1999. Companies went out of business because they couldn't pay their utility bills. Schools had to send students home because they didn't have power. Meanwhile, Enron's trading desk was booking over $200 million per month in profits. During this power crisis of 2000 and 2001, California paid $40 billion for electricity, which was four times the cost for a similar period from a year earlier. And Enron was largely to blame. Okay, so this is an interesting part of the story, but how does it tie into the bigger picture? Enron's trading teams had made over $2 billion in profits in 2000, but Enron didn't want Wall Street to know these numbers because Enron positioned themselves as a logistics company, not a trading company. If Wall Street realized Enron made the bulk of their profits from trading, a volatile business where consistent growth is impossible, they wouldn't be treated as a growth company and their share price would suffer. So instead of reporting the profit, Enron booked $1 billion as a reserve against potential lawsuits in California. And of course, this amount wasn't disclosed publicly. So continued Enron's practice of deception. All right, we briefly talked about the broadband business earlier, but I want to dig into some of the details because it's a crucial part of the story. As I mentioned before, broadband was supposed to be a cash cow business for Enron, a big enchilada, as Skilling called it. His horseshoe and hand grenade estimate, another phrase he loved, was that for every billion Enron invested in broadband, it would increase the company's market cap by $20 billion. There are some strong parallels between how Skilling represented the broadband business and how Elizabeth Holmes represented Theranos. I mentioned this briefly earlier. Namely, both of them touted technology and customers that didn't exist, or as they saw it, didn't exist yet. From day one, Skilling claimed that the business should add $37 per share to Enron's stock price. Here's what one of the employees said about the business. Enron Broadband was a reasonably decent concept with reasonably decent technology, adds a former Enron managing director who worked in the business. Given 6 years to develop the technology and the business plan without making representations about a $29 billion market value, it had a decent shot of doing something unique. Demanding first quarter results in a startup communications business is really what led to some of the things that were done. They put out the projection, and then you've got to do some questionable things to make it happen. This left the broadband executives facing a nightmarish scenario. They would have to somehow manage to build an entirely new industry from scratch in an incredibly short time against astonishing odds. And in the meantime, they would have to resort to creating a portrait of reality that simply didn't exist. So what exactly was this business supposed to do? Enron had two main plans. The first was broadband trading. The basic idea here was that businesses paid for more bandwidth than they needed, specifically outside of business hours, so they could sell their evening and weekend bandwidth to residential customers. Instead of laying new lines to accommodate more bandwidth, they could just transfer the bandwidth elsewhere to accommodate demand. But there were many problems with this plan. Here's an excerpt from the book. As a practical matter, the kind of real-time switching Enron envisioned was impossible. Transferring high-capacity bandwidth meant sending workers out to change connections by hand, a process that took days, if it was possible to switch them at all. Two companies that leased lines had no way of hooking up to use each other's bandwidth. For all practical purposes, when it came to high-capacity bandwidth, the information superhighway was like a series of parallel roads that never intersected. Enron claimed to be rolling out the capability to change that through its Enron Intelligent Network. This network, with its powerful new operating software, was the foundation for all of Enron Broadband's promises, including instantaneous electronic switching. Enron had claimed back in 1999 that its network offered a highly reliable, pay-for-what-you-need, bandwidth-on-demand way to deliver data. Enron's idea was to connect customers through a few dozen pooling points in key cities around the country, which would act much like transfer hubs in the gas pipeline business. As a practical matter, this capability to deliver real-time bandwidth on demand was what made trading useful and attractive, and critical to Enron's prediction in its 1999 annual report that the robust merchant operation it was building would allow the bandwidth trading market to reach critical mass by 2001. In fact, the Enron network couldn't provide bandwidth on demand and never would. The switching capability was still under development, as were other advanced features of Enron's system. Yet Enron continued to portray most of its key components as present-day reality. Enron kept issuing fresh press releases boasting about network capabilities that didn't exist. As I mentioned before, just change the names and you have the Theranos story. The other big plan for broadband was video on demand. Back to the book here. Enron was promising to establish a profitable new entertainment business by streaming programming for consumers, such as on-demand movies and sport events, over its global broadband network. The company would make money by charging consumers on a pay-per-view basis. Never mind that Enron had no experience with that sort of thing. Video on demand was full of gnarly problems that stymied even veteran entertainment companies. Most homes didn't have the high-speed broadband telephone lines that Enron was planning to use for on-demand video. Those that did were connected to computers. The Enron plan called for video to be streamed into television sets. Providing such digital TV video required a new kind of set-top box that would cost $500 apiece. While the boxes were under development, one of them burst into flames. And, not least, Enron was competing with the cable television industry, which had a giant built-in advantage. It already had wires and boxes in millions of American homes. Attempting even one of these plans would have been an enormous undertaking for any company, requiring a tremendous commitment of resources, time, and talent. To try to do them all at once, without any previous experience, virtually overnight, it was crazy. As we've seen time and again, Enron was good at coming up with ideas and signing deals. They were not good at execution and generating real cash from deals. That would continue to be the case with broadband. My favorite story from the broadband business was their deal with Blockbuster. Enron signed a 20-year agreement with Blockbuster to build a video-on-demand service where Blockbuster would use their connections to license content, and Enron would figure out how to stream it into homes. Enron was able to do a trial run of the service in four cities, but the trial only involved a few hundred customers. This is a hilarious excerpt. Though Enron had boasted of allowing customers to choose from a large library of movies, the trial offered a feeble collection of offerings. The standard fee was $5 a film. Enron's share was just $1.20. But many of the customers in the test markets weren't even charged. Even then, few used the service. Each household watched an average of just 1.8 videos a month, half of what Enron expected. Broadband executives sat in meetings poring over reports on the pilot's comically pathetic results. The Care Bears movie? 7 purchases, $8.40. When Cox excitedly reported his movie proceeds at one gathering, another executive handed him a $5 bill and said, "I just doubled your revenue." So even though the Blockbuster deal seemed like it was going to be a bust, Enron found a way to report profits. Just like they had done many times before, they calculated a value for the 20-year deal with Blockbuster and sold the future cash flow to two special purpose entities. They called this Project Braveheart. So how did they value this 20-year contract? Here's an explanation from the book. To book the profits it needed, Enron had to assume that by the year 2010, the company's content business would be operating in 82 cities, that 32% of the households in those markets would be using DSL lines, that 70% of the DSL customers using video on demand would subscribe to the Enron Blockbuster service, and that Enron would control 50% of the video on demand market. Those were some bold assumptions considering how big of a flop the trial run was. Now let's look at how this whole thing ended. Back to the book. In the end, Enron Broadband Services claimed a $53 million gain on Braveheart for the fourth quarter, representing 84% of the broadband division's revenues. 2 months after booking $53 million in profits from Project Braveheart, Enron announced it was ending its 20-year deal with Blockbuster. Enron publicly blamed Blockbuster, saying the video giant had failed to provide the quantity and quality of movies the project needed. One person who took particular note of the dissolution of the Blockbuster deal was Carl Bass at Arthur Andersen. One would think, he emailed a colleague, there should be a loss reported, but that was hardly Enron's style. Instead of writing down the value of the deal, the company's finance executives reasoned that its broadband content business was worth more without Blockbuster, since it wouldn't have to share the proceeds. As the bankruptcy examiner Riley noted, apparently Enron's intention to initiate discussions was even more valuable than its exclusive relationship with Blockbuster. Enron Broadband Services booked an additional $58 million from Braveheart, more than two-thirds of its reported revenues for the first quarter of 2001. Thus, was one last quarter saved. Blockbuster executives say they were astounded to find out months later that Enron had booked $111 million in profits on their unprofitable venture. Booking $111 million in profits on an unprofitable venture. If that doesn't scream Enron, I don't know what does. The end for Enron began with the end of the bull market in the spring of 2000. This is from the book. Where investors had once cheered the market's every move, now they grew angry as their savings dwindled and they realized they had gotten caught up in a classic bubble. As stocks sank, the game changed. Momentum investors were selling instead of buying. Skeptical voices that had been ignored during the great bull run were suddenly getting a hearing, and companies that hit or beat their earnings target could no longer be assured of a rising stock price. Investors were newly curious about how companies had arrived at those earnings. They were digging deeper and asking questions. In the bull market, investors always saw the glass as half full. Now, for the first time in years, they were seeing it as half empty. As we've discussed numerous times this season, frauds are a product of the times. It was true with Madoff, Theranos, FTX, and Rudy. Bull markets, low interest rates, new innovations, whatever the case may be, frauds happen when something in the environment creates a vulnerability, and then the fraudster preys on that vulnerability. As the saying goes, the times, they were a-changin'. Where Enron used to ride high on bullshit and earnings growth, they now had questions to answer. The two big groups asking questions were the short sellers and the journalists. Let's start with the short sellers. The well-known short seller Jim Chanos came across a news story questioning energy companies' use of mark-to-market accounting. If you remember way back, we discussed Skilling's insistence on using mark-to-market accounting. Jump back to part one if you need a refresher, but the most important thing to remember is that under mark-to-market accounting, companies can book the entire expected earnings from the life of a contract when they sign the contract, not when the money comes in. So that news story Chanos read basically said that outsiders had no way of knowing the assumptions that companies like Enron used to book their earnings. Also, a huge part of those earnings were not cash. So Chanos started digging. This is from the book. After Chanos saw Jonathan Wild's story in the fall of 2000, he flipped open Enron's 1999 10K. He read, "The market prices used to value these transactions reflect management's best estimates." He thought, a license to print money. He began talking to Enron's competitors, Wall Street analysts, and virtually anyone else he thought might have information on the company. The more Chanos poked around, the more he felt that the Enron story didn't make sense. Chanos had made a fortune researching, then shorting, telecom stocks. He knew how much trouble they were in. How could Enron's broadband unit be doing so well when the rest of the industry was on life support? "We know telecom cold," he said, "and here's Enron bleating about this great opportunity." Enron's return on invested capital was abysmally low, around 7%, and that figure didn't even include the billions upon billions of off-balance sheet debt. "They were chewing up capital," says Chanos. He was struck by a three-paragraph disclosure in Enron's third quarter 2000 filing about its dealings with a related party. No matter how many times he read it, he still couldn't understand what it said. He showed it to derivatives specialists, corporate lawyers, and other experts. They couldn't figure it out either. Chanos thought they must be trying to hide something. And then there were the insider sales. Lay was consistently selling about 2,500 shares a day. Skilling was also selling in big chunks. Chanos and the others who shorted Enron stock didn't have any special information that wasn't available to the bulls. "As soon as anyone looked, they could see the stuff we saw," says Chanos today. At first, he adds, "we didn't think it was some great hidden fraud. We just thought it was a bad business." By November 2000, he had begun taking a big short position in Enron stock. I want to highlight something important here. "As soon as anyone looked, they could see the stuff we saw," says Chanos. Why is this important? Well, we saw almost the exact same thing with the Madoff story. If you think back to episode one, you'll remember a quote from Nat Simons from the hedge fund Renaissance Technology. Renaissance decided to get out of their Madoff investments after doing some of their own research. He said, "Despite the fact that we are kind of smart people, we were just looking at matters of public record. It's not like we needed a PhD in mathematics." So what's the lesson here? Oftentimes, the information you need to spot a fraud is available. All you have to do is look. Keep in mind that you may not know for sure something is a fraud. Like Chano said, he just thought it was a bad business. But you'll have simple questions without simple answers, and that will indicate it's time to walk away. Okay, back to the story here. Naturally, a big short seller taking a big short position creates interest, so journalists started calling. Chanos gave them some pretty simple answers. Back to the book here. After pointing out how low Enron's return on invested capital was, he added, "Would you put your money in a hedge fund earning a 7% return? Read the 10K and see if you can figure out how they're making money." The two men also noted that Enron was a speculative trading shop, which meant that at an absolute minimum, its outside price to earnings multiple made no sense. "You don't give these things a 50 multiple, even if it's the Goldman Sachs of the energy business," said Chanos. Chanos was right. When you took the time to pore through Enron's financial documents, it wasn't hard to find scratches on its shiny surface. While Enron's reported earnings were growing smoothly, the business didn't seem to be generating much cash. And you can't run a business without cash. In fact, Enron had negative cash from operations in the first 9 months of 2000. There were other warning signs. Enron's debt was climbing rapidly. $3.9 billion of debt was added on the balance sheet in the first 9 months of 2000 alone, which didn't make sense if the business was as profitable as Enron was claiming. It was also clear that Enron was selling assets and booking the proceeds as recurring earnings. In fact, publicly filed documents showed that nearly 40% of Enron's earnings in 1998 and 1999 came from gains on sales of assets rather than from ongoing operations. So this section highlights one of our maxims pretty nicely. Ask simple questions, demand simple answers. Questions like, how is Enron valuing these contracts, and are those values reasonable? Or, how exactly does Enron make money? Or, if Enron makes most of their money trading, why aren't they valued like a trading company? During the mania of the bull market, few people were asking these questions. But when people finally started asking them, Enron didn't seem to have good answers. One of the people asking questions was Bethany McLean, the co-author of the book we're talking about today. She sat down with Fastow. Here's how that meeting went. Fastow's explanation of Enron's business did not exactly provide the promised clarity. On the contrary, here's how Fastow explained Enron's business model. "We create optionality. Enron is so much more valuable, hence our stock price, because we have so much more optionality embedded in our network than anyone else." Fastow then compared Enron to Toyota. Enron, too, was an assembler rather than a manufacturer. "Our disclosure is more complete than anyone's," Fastow insisted. A moment later, he seemed to say precisely the opposite. "We don't want to tell anyone where we're making money." Like Skilling, Fastow insisted that Enron did not make its money speculating. "It's not trading, it's optimization," he said. The proof? Enron's earnings record in the wholesale business. "We have for 20 straight quarters exceeded the previous one. There's not a trading company in the world that has that kind of consistency." That explanation sounds like word salad to me. McLean ended up publishing an article titled, "Is Enron Overpriced?" It didn't offer a lot of answers, but it posed some interesting questions. Questions like, how does Enron make money? It also pointed out Enron's lack of cash flow and ever-increasing debt. On the back of the short sellers and the investigative journalism, Enron's share price continued to fall. From $82 in early 2001 to under $70 by the end of February, and the decreasing share price created issues in the special purpose entities. The deals with the SPEs all had provisions involving stock price. When the stock price dropped, Enron either had to repay, issue more shares, or report losses. So Enron simply restructured the deals. These particular deals were referred to internally as the Raptors. Back to the book here. The Raptor restructuring closed on March 26th, just in time. 4 days later, the first quarter came to a close, and the Raptors had shielded another $200 million in losses. And though the word Raptors was never used, and there was never any precise description of what these entities accomplished, the restructuring itself was disclosed in Enron's first quarter filing. Mind you, it wasn't disclosed in a fashion that any outsider could interpret. But if you took a skeptical eye to the sentence in Enron's first quarter SEC filing that read, "Enron received notes receivable from the entities totaling approximately $827.6 million, you might suspect that something enormous had happened. So that little excerpt again underlines the idea that the information you need is usually publicly available. You may not know exactly what is wrong, but you should be able to see that something is wrong if you're paying attention. In the meantime, a lawyer at Enron started digging into Fastow's ownership of LJM and realized that this was a major liability for the company. The lawyer expressed his concerns to Skilling, and Skilling ultimately made Fastow choose between Enron and LJM. Fastow ended up selling his stake in LJM to one of his minions, a guy named Michael Copper, who left Enron to take over LJM. It would seem like this was the end of the LJM story, but it'll come back up later. And then there was more attention from another short seller. This is from the book. On May 6th, Enron's mind-numbingly complex financial disclosures became one of the subjects of a skeptical report written by Mark Roberts, a well-respected short seller and researcher who runs a firm called Off Wall Street Consulting. Roberts dug deeply into Enron's financial report for 2000, which had been released in late March. He noted Enron's increased reliance on trading and the seeming cluelessness of the street analysts who were recommending the stock. He scrutinized the related party transactions and noted that none of the numerous industry experts and analysts he asked were able to explain the footnotes to him. He also noted other oddities revealed in that filing, such as the information that Enron had received $2.4 billion in proceeds from securitizations, and that Enron, by using swaps, appeared to be retaining an unknowable amount of risk. These are, in effect, sales with recourse to Enron, Roberts wrote. One of Roberts' most devastating revelations had to do with Enron's cash flow. In 2000, Enron reported an unprecedented $4.8 billion in operating cash flow. Roberts noted that almost $2 billion of it was from customer deposits. Because energy prices were so high, Enron's counterparties had to provide more collateral. But this money didn't really belong to Enron. If prices fell, it would have to be returned to the counterparties. Roberts also noted that another $1 billion in cash flow had come from a one-time sale of inventory. Although Roberts didn't know it, another $1.5 billion in cash flow was the result of prepay transactions. In other words, much of the $4.8 billion in cash flow wasn't cash flow at all. It was merely the illusion of cash flow. Though most of the mainstream business press was unaware of Roberts' report, it was widely circulated among hedge fund managers and other large institutional investors. A reporter named Peter Evis followed up on Roberts' research and began writing a string of negative stories about Enron. Slowly, the heat was being turned up. If this wasn't enough of a hit for Enron, broadband was creating more problems. It was hemorrhaging money and not generating any meaningful revenue. By July of 2001, Enron rolled broadband into their wholesale business. The failure had cost Enron over $1 billion, and now the illusion of Enron as an internet company was no more. By this time, the share price had dipped below $50, and it would never again close above $50 a share. Okay, in the meantime, the situation at Enron continued to spiral out of control. Several employees raised concerns to management as whistleblowers, but their concerns were largely ignored or minimized. By this point, Skilling had resigned, and the company was being run by a guy named Greg Wally. Wally wanted to clean up as much of Enron's mess as quickly as possible, and part of that mess was the special purpose entities referred to as the Raptors. With Enron's sinking share price, these deals were again underwater, and Enron had to terminate the Raptor partnerships. That, along with the broadband charges and write-downs of failed development deals, meant Enron had to report a $1 billion loss, which they sneakily categorized as a non-recurring charge. Then, shortly after the bad earnings release, Fastow was raked over the coals in the Wall Street Journal. A series of articles over a few days highlighted his relationship with LJM, LJM's relationship with Enron, and the fact that Fastow had made millions from this relationship. So after these articles came out, the Enron board realized they were in trouble. This is from the book. It was now painfully obvious that the media knew more about Andy's partnerships than the Enron board did. The directors struggled to recall just what they had been told about the money Fastow made from the partnerships. Back in October 2000, the directors actually asked the compensation committee to check on the CFO's compensation from the partnerships. The committee chair, LeMaistre, even made a feeble attempt to carry out the request. Initially, he asked Mary Joyce, an Enron compensation executive, to give him information on the outside income for all of Enron's top management. 6 months later, he asked again. When no information arrived, LeMaistre simply dropped the matter. Now the board belatedly resolved to do the obvious. Ask Fastow directly. All right, let's fast forward to that meeting with the board. Back to the book here. What was your aggregate income attributable to LJM1 and LJM2, inclusive of salary, consulting fees, management fees, partnership distributions, and gain on the sale of your partnership interest? For more than a year, Fastow had bobbed and weaved, dodging bosses, lawyers, and security regulations to avoid addressing this very question. But now, backed into a corner, he gave the directors a startling answer. He had made $23 million on LJM1 and another $22 million on LJM2. Fastow was telling them he'd pocketed $45 million on a partnership that was supposedly occupying him just 3 hours a week, and he'd made that money doing deals with Enron. In fact, Fastow's true take was even larger, $60.6 million. What was his rate of return, LeMaistre asked. Fastow said that he had invested $1 million in LJM1 and $3.9 million in LJM2, but he couldn't immediately tell them his rate of return. I'm going to pause and let that sink in for a moment. Fastow made $60 million on a $5 million investment. He made that money on deals with Enron through his private equity fund while he was still the CFO of Enron. What I find most astonishing about this whole thing is that the board should have known what was going on. They had to approve these deals. They could have insisted on seeing this information, but they chose not to. It seems like they probably knew what was going on and they chose to turn a blind eye. The day after this meeting between Fastow and the board, Fastow was fired. And all the while, as Enron is reporting huge losses, as Fastow's dealings are being published for the world to see, as the SEC launches an inquiry, Enron's share price is ticking lower and lower and lower. $34 per share on October 16th, $26 per share on October 19th, $21 per share on October 22nd, $17 per share on October 24th, lower and lower and lower. And you remember what happens when the share price drops. It triggers repayments in Enron's various special purpose entity deals. But that was the least of their worries. This is from the book. By the time of Fastow's firing, Enron's perception problem had evolved into something far worse, a cash crisis. With Enron's stock continuing to sink, panic was taking hold. The immediate problem was that Enron had been unable to roll its commercial paper. McMahon was shocked to hear this. "If we can't roll commercial paper, we can't pay the janitor," he told Wally. "We have no cash." Enron, McMahon quickly realized, needed $1 billion, maybe $2 to $3 billion, fast, before word trickled out and a rush of panicked creditors shut the company down. The new CFO launched a desperate phone-a-thon, dialing up the big banks and asking them, on a moment's notice, to write checks for $500 million or more. But this time, the answer came back from everyone. Nothing. No one would move that fast. Not for Enron. Not now. So that is very much like what we saw when FTX was out of cash. Everyone who had once been a supporter immediately decided they were not supportive anymore. And then Enron began to fall very quickly. They had about $3 billion in unsecured credit that they began drawing on, but this was an immediate signal to everyone that Enron was in a bad spot. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, most of Enron's SPE deals had triggers for immediate repayment if the stock price dropped low enough and their credit rating dropped. The stock price was already below those triggers, and now that Enron was tapping their emergency credit lines, the rating agencies changed Enron's credit outlook, signaling that they were likely to downgrade the credit rating. While all this was happening, Arthur Andersen realized that they would be in the crosshairs, so they started covering their tracks. Some useful context here. Andersen was under a cease and desist order related to their work for Waste Management, where there was a $1 billion accounting fraud. In that case, Andersen had loads of internal documents that implicated them as guilty. As a result, they updated their documentation policy to say that everything that isn't an essential part of the audit file should be deleted. In light of everything happening with Enron, Andersen reminded everyone about their documentation policy, and they began shredding everything in sight. Here's a passage from the book. "The machine at Andersen's Enron office was quickly overwhelmed. Dozens of trunks and boxes filled with documents, more than a ton of paper, were shipped to the main downtown office, where files awaiting destruction spilled out into the hallways outside the shredding room. It was more than the entire Houston office typically shredded in an entire year. The load was so great that Andersen summoned a shredding truck from a local disposal company called Shred It. Andersen's offices in London, Portland, and Chicago joined in, shredding their Enron documents. In addition to the paper, almost 30,000 email messages and computer files were also deleted." And while Andersen was shredding dumpsters full of documents, they were finding mistake after mistake in Enron's books. Here's another excerpt. "This time, Andersen resolved no more games. Enron would need to restate its earnings all the way back to 1997, adding debt to its teetering balance sheet and wiping out a big chunk of its reported profits. All this was horrible news for both Arthur Andersen and Enron." So Enron was out of cash. They were struggling to get any loans. Their stock price was tanking. The credit agencies were about to downgrade them. Arthur Andersen was making them restate their earnings, and the SEC was opening an investigation. Really couldn't get much worse than this. By early November of 2001, they were in talks to be acquired by a competitor, Dynegy. The timing here was really tricky. Andersen was insisting Enron restate their earnings, and the SEC was insisting Enron disclose the nature and performance of Fastow's partnerships. Those were the LJM funds that he ran and made more than $60 million from. Both Andersen and the SEC wanted these disclosures to be made on Monday, November 5th. But Enron wanted to announce the Dynegy merger first, and that announcement wouldn't be ready until later in the week. Enron feared if they made the disclosures first, it would sink the company. So they got an extension from the SEC, allowing them to make the disclosure on Thursday. This is from the book. "By Thursday, November 8th, everything was ready to go. The boards of Enron, Dynegy, and Chevron Texaco had approved the merger. The rating agencies had been privately briefed. The press releases were prepared. First, Enron announced its restatement, consolidating the troubled partnerships and rewriting more than 4 years of its accounting history, about $586 million in profits, 20% of Enron's previously reported net income dating back to 1997, was simply erased. In a 21-page SEC filing, Enron told the truth about these issues for the first time. Partnerships were named, transactions described, and financial details disclosed. Fastow, Enron conceded, had made more than $30 million from the partnerships. The merger was supposed to be announced Thursday, too, but at 7 that morning, Moody's called with startling news. It planned to cut Enron's debt rating again, this time below investment grade. Moody's thought the combined company's balance sheet would be shaky, and it didn't like the terms of the merger. It gave Dynegy and the banks too many outs. This couldn't be allowed to stand. A junk bond rating would pull the triggers on billions of Enron's debt. The game would be over, for the Dynegy deal and for Enron. McMahon begged Moody's to hold off. If the rating agency didn't like the deal, they could change it. Moody's was non-committal, but agreed to listen. So after a little bit of scrambling, the deal was changed in a way that appeased the rating agency, and it was allowed to go forward. The deal brought in $2 billion of cash into Enron's accounts, but this was still not enough to cover their liquidity needs, so Enron continued trying to raise money from banks. They estimated they would need about $9 billion to cover debts coming due in the next year before the closing of the deal with Dynegy. Then, Enron released their third quarter earnings, revealing three terrible pieces of information. Their losses were higher than they had previously indicated. Issues with special purpose entity deals, including credit ratings downgrades, had triggered repayment obligations that would cause hundreds of millions in earning hits. And finally, their cash position was bad and getting worse. The Dynegy CEO was not happy. This is from the book. Watson went ballistic. He fired off a letter to Lay. We have not been consulted in a timely manner regarding developments since November 9th. We were not briefed in advance on the issues in your 10Q. Our team had to make repeated phone calls to your finance and accounting officials in an attempt to obtain information. Some of the most significant information in the Q was never shown to us at all. Watson added, we believe that Enron is going to have to do a far better job of communicating with us and with the marketplace for this transaction to reach a successful conclusion. Watson also gave Lay a call, telling him, you and I need to go to lunch, buddy. The Dynegy CEO was now harboring serious doubts about the deal. With this latest revelation, Enron was back on the ropes. By the end of that week, Enron's share price was below $5. So because of all this new information coming to light, Enron and Dynegy had to rework their deal. But at the same time, the ratings agencies were realizing that none of the big banks were putting up any money for Enron. It was simply a ticking time bomb. This is from the book. Wednesday, November 28th, as Watson waited, the rating agencies made the first move. S&P downgraded Enron two notches deep into junk company territory, citing its loss of confidence that the Dynegy merger will be consummated. Moody's and Fitch soon followed. The downgrades immediately triggered $3.9 billion in Enron debt. Watson placed a call to Lay, telling him the Dynegy board was terminating the deal. I'm disappointed this didn't work out. I wish you the best of luck, Watson said. I'm disappointed too, Lay responded. I'll go on to our other alternatives. Enron shares closed the day at 61 cents. Sunday, December 2nd was the day it finally happened. Electronically, at 2 a.m., Enron's lawyers filed the largest bankruptcy case in U.S. history. The Chapter 11 papers had been rushed together. Just days before, everyone was focused on the Dynegy deal. Once that collapsed, bankruptcy was really Enron's only alternative. So what happened in the aftermath? For one, Arthur Andersen ended up going out of business. They were indicted on criminal charges for destroying evidence, and even before they were convicted, their clients fled like fleas running from a fumigator. The firm had been around since 1913, and just like that, they were no more. How about the average employees? Enron, after all, employed some 20,000 people. Those employees lost about $2 billion in retirement funds. Many of them had huge portions of their retirement accounts in Enron stock. The larger community of Enron shareholders also lost their shirts. Even after a class action lawsuit that recovered $7.2 billion, investors lost 80 cents for every dollar they invested. And of course, what about the men responsible for the whole disaster? There was a huge cast of culpable characters, but I just want to tell you about Fastow, Lay, and Skilling. Let's start with Fastow's fate. First, a quick excerpt from the book. Those who wanted to blame all of Enron's woes on the greedy former CFO claimed that Enron had been a good business brought down by Andy Fastow, but that was never true. Ultimately, Enron was a bad business that was, for a time, propped up by Andy Fastow. I think that's important to remember. Fastow did a lot of bad things, but he was simply covering up for a bad business. Ken Lay, and even more so Jeff Skilling, were responsible for creating the bad business that needed covering up. So Fastow ended up copping a plea deal. He pled guilty to conspiracy to commit wire fraud and securities fraud. He cooperated with the investigation, and he received a 10-year sentence. He forfeited about $30 million, which was basically all that was left after his legal bills, and the judge ultimately reduced his sentence to 6 years. Next up, Ken Lay. In May of 2006, after a 16-week trial, Lay was found guilty on 10 counts of conspiracy, bank fraud, wire fraud, securities fraud, and making misleading statements. His sentencing was scheduled for October of that year, where he was expected to be sentenced to more than 20 years. But on July 5th, he died of a heart attack. And finally, Skilling. Skilling and Lay were tried together, and Skilling was found guilty of 19 of the 28 counts he faced, including conspiracy, fraud, and insider trading. This is from the book. The modern Enron, with all its errant ways, was Jeff Skilling's creation, and now Skilling would be left alone to face the public reckoning for himself and for the company he had built that had climbed so high and fallen so far. It came on October 23rd, 2006, when Judge Lake sentenced him to 24 years and 4 months in prison and a fine of $45 million. Skilling's request to remain free while he appealed his conviction was denied. He reported to a low-security prison in Waseca, Minnesota, and began serving his sentence on December 13, 2006, with a projected release date of 2028, when he would be 74 years old. Skilling was ultimately released from custody in 2019 after serving 12 years. As the authors wrote in the afterword, despite all the scandals, there is plenty that is right with American business today. Silicon Valley continues to create companies that change the way we live. Technical innovations are transforming the energy business. And across the country, tens of thousands of people whose names we'll never know regularly make tough decisions to behave ethically in the face of constant temptation to do otherwise. But if there's anything that's become clear in the last 10 years, it's that what can go wrong with business is something that can't be isolated to Enron or fixed by the simple act of making one man our pariah. In the end, that's why the Enron story will always be relevant. It's a tale of human nature, a morality play for our age. And that is where I'll leave you, to chew on those final words. It's a tale of human nature. That's why we're studying these frauds. From Madoff, to Theranos, to FTX, to Enron and others, they're tales of human nature. And human nature doesn't change. The settings may change, the characters may change, but the plots will stay the same. And by learning those plots, we stand a better chance of avoiding fraud in our businesses and investments. If you enjoyed this episode, I highly recommend buying the book. Like with the book on Madoff, this book goes into a lot of technical details that were simply beyond the scope of our conversation here, but are really interesting to learn about and understand. If you do buy the book using the link in the show notes, you'll be supporting the podcast, which I very much appreciate. And with that, we're one book closer to building better judgment as investors and entrepreneurs.